Superchargers, headlights, and more. With over 122 million parts, eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Stay on your A-game with all the parts you need at the prices you want. It's easy to bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's gotta be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
The Volume.
It's Boxing with Chris Mannix, presented by FanDuel. Football season is underway. Basketball is right around the corner, and there is no better place to get in on that action than FanDuel. The app is safe, secure, and easy to use. FanDuel always has exclusive offers. When you win, you'll get paid fast. FanDuel has a lot of ways to play, like the spread, money line, over-unders, team totals, player props, and so much more. Jump into the action at any time during the game with live betting. Combine multiple bets from the same game in a same game parlay and try out the same game parlay plus. So use the promo code BOXING and download the FanDuel app today to make every moment more during this football season. And get ready, NBA season is right around the corner.
This is Boxing with Chris Mannix.
Oh, somebody punch him in the face.
Anthony Joshua is a composed and ferocious finisher. Watch this.
Andy Ruiz is the heavyweight champion.
Hosted by SI's Chris Mannix.
That was my moment.
Now with interviews, analysis, and everything going on in the world of boxing.
When you have talent, you are given another chance.
Here's Chris Mannix.
All right, Kevin Ioli is here. Senior combat sports writer, boxing writer over at Yahoo Sports. He is joining me from Las Vegas, but from I'm sure Kevin is going to be boarding a flight for Dubai soon to check out the Floyd Mayweather-Deji showdown.
No doubt.
Out in the United Arab Emirates. I'll give this to Floyd, Kevin. He was masterful as a businessman during his active years. And he is masterful as a businessman during his retired years. He keeps taking on these no-hopers, making seven figures. Who knows what to believe and how much it is. But he's making seven figures and just like getting workouts in and seeing the world. It's the greatest retirement story that's ever been written, I think, or at least in boxing.
There's a lot of people that said, oh, when Floyd retires, he's going to be broke and he's not going to have any money. Nope. And I'll tell you what, you got to give the man credit. I mean, you know, he's found, I don't like these fights, of course, but you got to give him credit. He's found a way to make an income, keep his name in the news. And I think that that's going to help him with other things, you know, endorsements and things down the road, business opportunities, because he's just out there so much. And, you know, I mean, this guy that he's fighting lost to Jake Paul. I mean, it's not like he's
actually, if you include exhibitions, he's 1-3 as a boxer. He's the brother of KSI, is what he's best known as at this point. And look, if there's a market for it, it's going to be streamed on.
Is KSI known?
I mean, KSI is known in the UK for sure.
Okay, good.
He's got an audience there. He's got a huge social media following.
I always think of KSI as a radio station, that just shows how old I am.
Yeah, you're right. KSI, yeah. But no, but I mean, it's going to be on his own pay-per-view. He's going to make a lot of money. I'm sure some people will watch it. I'm actually more intrigued to see Tommy Fury on the undercard, just to see kind of, you know, as he has a potential opponent for Jake Paul down the line.
And does he slap Jake Paul as he said he was going
to
do?
Jake wants him to. Like, by the way, those two guys, like, they know what they're doing. Like, if Tommy Fury slaps Jake Paul, it's not going to be, like, looking to hurt him. It's going to be looking to build up buzz for a future fight.
Well, what he's going to do is he's going to turn around and look, or the camera's pointing at me, or everybody 100%. Looking. And once he sees that they are, then he will slap.
Well, there was a scene, I don't know if you remember this, in Cleveland where they had kind of an interaction in the hallway after Jake's fight. And one member, I think it was of Tommy's team, kind of got serious in the middle of it. And Tommy and Jake were looking at him like, what are you doing? No. We need the camera. We need this moment for social media to build up our fight. They're masters at that, and I think that'll be behind it. But look, good to spin it back to Floyd, good for him. He has no interest in taking a real fight. He has no interest.
And why should he?
No, nor should he. If you're making seven figures to travel the world and beat up on these, you know, first it was a couple of guys over in Japan. Now it's a social media influencer like Deji. He says he's going to be back in February in the UK. He can do this three times a year and clear more than virtually everybody in boxing at this point.
No, I mean, it's masterful. And, you know, it's amazingly changed because I was around, you know, I covered in person 43 of Floyd's 50 fights. And I was around when he was not a draw. And we used to write stories. Floyd Mayweather cannot sell tickets. And that was the truth back in the day. And the change that he made, you know, he's a genius now. I mean, and you know, he's figured out how to make money. And that character still works now. And there's still people that are into him. And you know, I've had people ask me, hey, do you think he'll give Logan Paul a rematch? Like, who cares?
Who cares? I wonder, now that I think of it, you're right. He wasn't a draw early on. He had to go to Jersey to fight Gotti to get Gotti's audience to follow him.
And I'll tell you this, just a real quick story. I was the first person to talk to him when he changed to the Money May character. And it was in the buffet at Caesars Atlantic City. And we're sitting next to the buffet, and the workers were getting ready to open it up. And there's all the ice that they put in the salad bar. And he's eating the ice as we're sitting there. And I had a great relationship with him. I had covered him actually in the amateurs at the Olympics. And so, you know, we had a good working relationship, and he had been Pretty Boy Floyd, always easygoing. All of a sudden, when I first asked him a question, he started, you know, with the Money May stuff and, like, really going off. And I'm like, what in the hell is going on here? And Lee Samuels from Top Rank, the Hall of Fame publicist, was going to have a conniption. I mean, he was sitting off to the side, and he didn't know what Floyd was doing. But and then once he finishes the interview, and we talk for about a half an hour, and he's just ripping Gotti up and down, and he looks at me, and he taps me on the leg, and he winks.
Look, it's definitely a character that he purposefully became, and good for him. He did it. I've often wondered, like, not to say Devin Haney is Floyd, but at some point in the next couple of years, if Devin Haney remains unbeaten and isn't as popular as he'd like to be, because he's kind of similar in the sense he doesn't really draw anywhere, doesn't have a home base. You know, maybe Northern California he can get there, maybe Vegas he can get there, but I wonder if he makes a similar heel turn in future years where it's like, fine, beat me. All right, if you want, you know, you can say I'm boring, but you can't beat me. I wonder. He's not as talented as Floyd. Because
but he's
Floyd,
very good.
He's very good. He's more hittable, I think, at this stage than Floyd was. But I can see Devin Haney making a turn like that and making a boatload of money off it down the line.
I think the problem for Devin is going to be he loses to Shakur. That's what I think. You know, I'm a big Shakur fan, and I think as a fighter, I think Shakur is better than he is. I think Devin is awesome, you know, and that's why I like that lightweight division. There's so many good fighters. But to your point, Chris, I think he could do that, right? Because Devin is a smart kid, right? And look at he's been doing, you know, traveling to all these fights. He's, you know, he was at the DAZN fight. He goes on the broadcast. He talks. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, at the Loma fight just recently, gone on the broadcast. He went in the ring afterwards. And then he released, I don't know if you noticed it, he released all those pictures. People were saying how fat he was after Loma. Mm-hmm. He got in the ring, and he released pictures of him eating ice cream and pizza and all these different things, which was clever on his part. But I think he needs more than that. Mm. And if he was a knockout artist, I would say he's okay. But he's not. You know, he doesn't have that kind of pop to really. And if he moves up, which I think everybody agrees, he's got maximum two, maybe one more fight at lightweight, and he's going up. I think his pop is going to be even less. So as a result, I think he needs to do something like Floyd did.
Yeah, I don't think a Shakur fight happens anytime soon. I think it's one more fight at lightweight because you saw him before the Lomachenko fight. Like, he was emaciated getting down to 135. Like, do it for Loma because that's a career-defining fight. But after that, go up to 140 where you can be physically stronger. And maybe your power gets a little bit better at a higher weight class. I don't know, but I think he's got a big future, and I'm curious to see where he goes personality wise moving forward. All right, we'll get to the next topic in just a second, but I have to tell our listeners here about NetSuite. 2000, 2008, 2022, when it comes to the economy, those are some scary years. Dot-com crash, housing crash, and the roller coaster we're going through right now. One thing is certain, it's a dangerous time to not know your numbers. But over 31,000 businesses have the confidence and clarity they need because they rely on NetSuite by Oracle, the number one cloud financial system. NetSuite gives you visibility and control of your financials inventory, HR, planning, and budgeting so you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need all in one place. So how do you prepare for uncertain times? The answer? NetSuite. NetSuite helps you identify rising costs, automate your business processes, and easily see where to save money. That's why 93% of customers say they improved their visibility and control when they upgraded to NetSuite. What are you waiting for? Right now, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/Mannix right now. netsuite.com/Mannix, netsuite.com/Mannix. So we are in Las Vegas. I'll be at the Top Rank show on Saturday, headlined by the latest WBO middleweight champion who will never fight anybody. Janabek, and I'm not going to try to pronounce his last name, because I tried it 7 times and I butchered it. Even Top Rank's not even trying. Like, they're putting in their hashtags is Janabek as his hashtag. He is defending his title this weekend, headlining a show at the Palms. That's going to be on ESPN Plus. In 2018, Demetrius Andrade won the WBO version of the middleweight title. He spent 3+ years not getting a significant fight. I'm getting a similar feeling here with Janabek. A hard-hitting southpaw.
Well, in his defense, he's only fought 12 pro fights.
Correct. But like, no. But I'm saying, like, as the WBO middleweight title holder, I don't think anybody's going to fight him.
Yeah.
He's a hard-hitting southpaw.
Right.
Like, if Demetrius Andrade, who was a, you know, brash-talking American without a lot of power, couldn't get someone at the top of the middleweight division to face him in unification fights, I have a hard time seeing Janabek getting those types
of
fights.
But I think there's a difference between Andrade and Janabek, and that's what you said, the punching power. You know, and Andrade was a guy that fought backwards, right? He's, you know, awkward to fight, and he just throws everything off. You know, Janabek's not like that. I mean, you know, he's a good boxer, but we'll see how good of a boxer he is, right? He, you know, we know he can punch. You know, some people say he's the hardest puncher in the division already. I want to say, let's see who he fights,
yeah,
right?
I'm beating, what was it?
Rob Brandt and Hassan and Dom and guys like that.
Danny Dayton, who did he beat in the last fight?
Durgan.
I mean, like, yeah, you're right. He's got to face elite competition, but I don't think he gets it. Like, I don't think anybody's going to line up to fight him. Like, who coming up from 154 is going to be like, that's the title I want. I'm going to fight Janabek.
And he's calling out Charlo. Like, you know, Charlo has not fought anybody since he won the, you know, middleweight title. You're not going to see him do that.
Charlo, as we're recording this, the WBC is having their convention. Are they going to do anything about Jermall Charlo at this point? He's been off for over a year,
right,
like holding that belt hostage at this point.
I don't understand how that works and how there are reporters actually in Acapulco who do not call them on these kind of things and write about it. Instead of just saying, here's what they ordered, call them on these kind of things, you know, and that I try to write that kind of stuff and call out, and I get caught, you know, ripped for being negative. I wrote a story last week and said, boxing is great. The sport of boxing is great, but the business of boxing sucks. And all these, you
suck.
Know, boxing writers, you know, oh, he's negative, he's this, he's that. And they're pointing to fights between two guys that you know, you and I heard of, but the average public has no idea as they are, is an example of something good in boxing. And, you know, I think if you want to do something good for boxing, go to that WBC convention in Acapulco and call them on it and say, what are you going to do about this, and force him to fight. But if they have no public pressure from the media, then they're going to do, you know, they're going to just let these kind of things happen. It's just ridiculous.
Well, I mean, look, the other example of it is, and it's small potatoes, I guess, but ranking Keith Thurman ahead of Virgil Ortiz in the WBC rankings. Yeah. How do you explain that? Keith Thurman has had, what, one win since the Pacquiao fight? Like, Virgil Ortiz has been active. He's been knocking guys out. He's been increasing his level of competition every single time. How do you have Keith Thurman ahead of Ortiz, if only because you want to present it as a potential mandatory for Errol Spence? That's laughable.
100%. That's all
laughable
they're doing.
Laughable what they're doing there. So to spin it back to Janabek here for a second, like, I think he's exceptionally talented. Buddy McGirt, Negus Klimas think he's the best fighter of this generation. Like, they're talking a lot about Janabek. I love him. I love Buddy. Tremendous trainer.
Buddy's
having a
awesome
nice surge as a trainer in recent years. Negus is a proven talent evaluator over the years. But I'm with you. I need to see him against better guys. I just don't know who that guy is. Like, Jaime Munguia has been named as his mandatory.
Oh.
There is a better chance of you getting in the ring with Janabek than Jaime Munguia doing it.
I mean, what Golden Boy is getting away with Jaime Munguia is unbelievable. The opponents that they are giving
him.
Put it on
Fernando Beltran, too, there a little bit. Like,
I mean,
it's on both of them that with the Munguia stuff.
But, you know, I got to know Fernando Beltran in the 90s when Fernando Beltran had, you know, Eric Morales and Arce and all those guys. And they fought everybody. And, of course, that a lot to do with the fighter. But, I mean, you know, Jaime Munguia now, you know, he got turned down for the Golovkin fight. What was it? 18 in 18. Tom Loeffler wanted to have him fight Golovkin in 18. So that told me, hey, this guy had some, you know, intestinal fortitude that he's willing to take on Golovkin at such a young age, at a prime Golovkin at that point. So I don't think it's him. I think it's the people around him saying, we don't believe in him, and we're going to lose our gravy train if we put him in with somebody who can actually fight. And so Oscar and Fernando and whoever else is on the management team, Eric Gomez, all these people, they find soft touch after soft touch after soft touch, and we're really not getting to see what this guy has.
The amazing thing to me is that if he fought Jermall Charlo right now, I'd make him a slight favorite. If he fought Gennady Golovkin right now, I'd make him a slight favorite. I think he's improved that much over the last couple of years. I've had the opportunity to call most of his recent fights, and I think his defense is getting a little bit better. His offense is getting exponentially better. He throws 6, 7, 8 punch combinations every single time. He has a great chin. Like, he's shown that.
He rarely has anything coming back. So if you have in one round the guy fires back at you, you know, your defense and your offense can also be good because you're not worried as much, right? You know, you're in there against Charlo and you know he can hit. And, he, you know, whatever you think of Charlo, and I agree there's inherent problems with Charlo. But, you know he can hit.
Yeah.
And he's quick and he's athletic. And so he's going to create, you know, issues in – you know, Jaime's fighting these guys that he's a 20-1 favorite. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. And you know, the public deserves better. The television deserves better, and he deserves better. And I think he has some talent. Like the fact, you know, when he beat I was going to say Obakar. Who was it that he beat?
Gabe Rosado.
Gabe Rosado, the welterweight that he beat for a title. The slick boxer.
Yes, the one that beat Cotto, and I'm now blanking on all
Okay,
of
we're
this.
Both blanking.
Yes.
But, he could fight. He was a good, you know, much smaller, but he moved up to 154, fought. And I thought at that point, hey, this kid is, you know, has got something in him. And then he wanted to fight Golovkin right after that. But now, like...
Saddam Ali.
That's
there
it.
We go. Yeah.
The fact that he's so... acquiescent to what his management wants to do tells me, you know, that he's willing just to pick up paychecks and not really, you know. I loved what Dmitry Bivol said last week to you in the ring. Mm. It's not about money. It's about legacy. And to me, when I heard that, I felt so good because that's what I've been dying to hear fighters say. And God bless you, Dmitry Bivol, for saying that.
I believe him, too. You know, I believe all things being equal, Dmitry Bivol would happily take an Archer Beterbiev fight over Canelo, even if the money was not as substantial. So I think he's about that legacy. So let's talk about Bivol. For a second, coming off the win in Abu Dhabi this weekend, I'm blank. Gilberto Ramirez, of course, coming off the win over Zerto. Second straight big win of the year for Dmitry Bivol. First of all, what did you think about his performance last weekend?
I thought he looked good. I think, what did I have? A 10-2, I believe I had.
I had it right around there. Maybe 9-3.
And I just thought Zerto did not fight, right? I mean, I was disappointed in Zerto. Like, and Zerto's another guy. He had been matched easily almost his whole career. Like, his hardest fights were probably Jesse Hart. And Jesse Hart's a tough guy, but he's not an elite boxer. And that was Zerto's toughest fight. So now you get up to a guy, a world-class guy, you know, arguably a top 10 pound-for-pound guy, and he was in over his head. And I think he realized that, and, you know, Bivol was quicker. Bivol was a better boxer. And I think Bivol was actually the bigger puncher of the two, right? Bivol wasn't sitting down on his punches because he didn't need to take the risk. But I think if Zerto was firing back at him. But I was really impressed with Bivol. And he shows movement in the ring. He has different combinations. And he's smart. You know, he makes adjustments on the fly. I was really impressed. I'll tell you what, I love Arthur Beterbiev, but that is a tough fight for Beterbiev. Beterbiev hits you and you're in trouble, but good luck hitting Dmitry Bivol with a good one, too.
Bivol has tremendous footwork, tremendous defense, and he does punch hard. Like, he's not the knockout artist we thought he was going to be when he was coming up the ranks on HBO, knocking out everybody. Sullivan Barrera was on that hit list early on, but he's not a light puncher by any stretch. If he was, Gilberto Ramirez would have come forward, and he didn't. He was fighting most of that fight going backwards.
And he fought that little crouch because, and I think, you know, he wanted to make himself a more difficult target because he felt what was coming at him.
One of the big questions we had coming in was what was Gilberto Ramirez really made of. He was 5-0 at light heavyweight, but he had faced C-level competition at best. You'd probably say Yonesky Gonzalez might have been the best fighter he had faced. And I don't blame Ramirez for that, because two of those fights were eliminators. So he's got to put himself in position to force the fight against Bivol, because if he hadn't, Bivol would have fought Buatsi on that weekend, and he wouldn't have been in that position. But in that fight, we learned that maybe Zerto, certainly not the power puncher we thought he was at 175. All that being said, I don't blame, people are piling on Zerto a little bit. The guy fought the best guy. He fought a top 10 pound for pound guy. We want him to avoid these fights? Do we want him to be like Munguia in those situations?
No, I'm with you. I criticized him to a certain degree. I said he was exposed. But I wasn't criticizing him for, especially at light heavyweight, what he had done. But I was saying I was criticizing his management team, right? Mm-hmm. His old management team and his new management team. Because, you got to, I wish in boxing they would learn. And I think there's a lot of smart people out there. But they still worry about losses. I don't think the TV networks care as much about losses as these managers and some fans seem to think they do. You know what? If you show up and you give me a good fight, people are going to want to see you, and the networks are going to want to put you on. And I think that they just were so low risk with Zerto that the first really good fighter he fought, there's no question Bivol's an A fighter. And when he got in the ring with an A fighter, he was ill-equipped to deal with it. And I think Zerto is talented enough that had he seen that prior, maybe you're not going to see a Dimitri Bivol prior, but, some better, there were some good guys at 68 when he was there. Mm-hmm. He could have fought some of those guys. He would have been more equipped for this, and I think would have been had a better chance of winning. I don't think he would have ever won that fight, but he would have had a chance.
And even if you lose in boxing, if you get one low-level win, you're all the way back. And it's like, all right, now we want to see him back. If Zerto went out and knocked somebody out in his next fight, be like, well, is he going to fight a cruiserweight? Is he going to fight for a title there? I mean, losses, we could go all day long on that. Don't mean anything. All right. The question now for Dimitri Bivol going forward is what's next? It certainly sounds like Archer Beterbiev is headed for that fight against Anthony Yard in the first quarter
of January.
Next year. January, February, something like that. It's the WBO mandatory. He's got to do it to keep his belt. It's already signed, sealed, and delivered, according to people I've talked to with Top Rank. But if there's an option for Bivol in May or June of next year, what's the bigger fight for him in your mind? Is it that unification fight with Archer Beterbiev, or is it a rematch with Canelo, a generational pound-for-pound talent, which could conceivably take place at 168 pounds, which would put Bivol in position to fight for the undisputed championship there?
He commented to you in the ring in Abu Dhabi, and I think he showed you, he said, I'm a light heavyweight, and, that's a tough cut. He's an amazing athlete. He's lean, and at 175, now you're going to ask him to take 7 pounds off against a world-class fighter like Canelo. That is a really, really difficult thing to do. I think if his team and he, if they get a nutritionist and they feel like they can make it, that fight is both a money fight and a legacy fight. So it gives you both. Because if you beat Canelo, I think you put yourself in the Hall of Fame, given what he's already done. That is he may be in now as it is anyways. But I think if you beat Canelo a second time, you are a Hall of Famer. You've done that. You're stamping yourself as one of the greatest fighters in the world. There's no doubt he would be in the top 5 pound for pound at that point. Some people have him in the top 10 now. Some people have him just outside the top 10. He's in if he does that. But if on the side of fighting Beterbiev, you're going to go up against maybe the Mike Tyson of light heavyweights.
Yep.
A guy, what is he? Is he 17-0 with 17 knockouts, or 18-0 with
18 knockouts?
He just destroyed Joe Smith, a pretty good, solid fighter.
He's got a great chin. Went 12 rounds with Bivol.
And he destroys him. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even so if you go in there and you win the undisputed light heavyweight title by beating that guy, I think, again, you're going to look, hey, when you cop it on top of his win over Canelo and that. Again, this guy's saying, hey, this is a Hall of Fame fighter. So he has good choices to make. Obviously the Canelo fight is going to be the richer fight. I wonder if they can do this, if they could have Bivol and Beterbiev come back in maybe May and fight like after Canelo does, and then them fight in September on the rematch and do it that way. I don't know who you would put Canelo with in the interim if you did that, but I think that might be something for Bivol's team, that now he's the undisputed light heavyweight champion going up against the undisputed, and they can pull a Sugar Ray Leonard, Donnie Lalonde thing where weigh in at 168 and you're fighting for undisputed at both classes.
That's a good point. You could do both. Sugar Ray certainly did it. I would – Better BF doesn't just beat guys – ends careers.
Right.
Like he at one point ended Alexander Vostick's career. Unclear if we see Joe Smith ever again back in the ring. If I'm Bivol and I can in a healthy way get down to 168, I would push for that fight, because not only is there a lot of money, you would be the favorite going in. You would have a chance to win all the belts at 168 and do what nobody has ever done, which is win two undisputed champions on the men's side. Respect Clarissa Shields. Yeah. On the men's side, win two undisputed championships and do it in two fights.
Right.
Like, that would be a really remarkable and historical accomplishment. It all comes down to his ability to cut weight. And look, the only reason I bring it up, and I brought it up to him in the ring, is because he suggested it before. Like, when he was not getting fights at 175,
right,
he was talking about being able to cut down to 168. And that, to me, makes the Canelo fight a little bit more interesting. If it's Canelo Bivol at 175...
We've seen it.
Like, I don't think Canelo wins that fight. As great as Canelo is, I think that's a bridge too far for him to go up against a fighter like that at that weight class. At 168, you take a little bit out of Dimitri Bivol, maybe his speed, maybe his reflexes, maybe they go a little bit. You give yourself a little bit more of a chance. That fight interests me, Kevin. I would be more on board for Bivol Canelo at 168 right now than I am for Bivol Beterbiev. The other part of it is, you just can't count on Artur Beterbiev to be healthy. Like, you just, well, if you're banking on
why
him,
why he's
to
only
be
fought less than 20 times.
If you're banking on him to be able to fight in June or May or June, I don't know
after
if
after he fought
at
the late January.
After, I mean, I personally don't think Anthony Yarn's
I talked to John Scully about him, though, and John Scully is confident that he could come back. One of his trainers.
I don't believe the Yard fight's going to go very long. Anthony Yard, good for him for getting in this position, but he's Beterbiev is a steamroller, man, and I don't think Yard can put up the resistance to him.
A lot of people, like I was talking to some people at Top Rank and criticizing the fight, right? After the Joe Smith fight, I was no with Anthony Yard. And I don't understand why boxing likes those kind of fights and why the organizations make these kind of mandatories. Because you know what? It benefits them, and then they're not going to get crap from people like you and me if they look and they say, hey, you know what? Let's set it up so that we can have this big fight, you know, whoever the big fight happens to be. But in this case, like a Bivol and him, like set it up for that, because now it's going to be a big money fight, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to an Anthony Yard fight, which is, you know, going to be a little bit less. And then theoretically a Canelo fight. I don't understand. And boxing likes to put these goofy little fights in there, and I don't think you need it. And to me, that's something on the business side. I love what's going on in boxing today. I think there's so many. I've covered boxing for what, 40 years. I covered fights in the 70s, and I think that current talent now, the world championship level talent and just below that on the way up, is as good as it's been, like, you know, maybe in the late 80s, mid 80s. You know, there's a lot of guys in a lot of divisions. Plus, you see some of these kids coming up are 5-0, 6-0. I'm not 100% sold on Ashton Silva yet, but the kid that fought on the Jake Paul undercard, but I think he's a guy I look at and go, you know, maybe he is something. I'm not 100% there on him yet, but he's a guy that attracted my interest. So why not take advantage of this and promote these great fighters and promote them in big fights? Because you know what? I know Ryan Garcia wants to fight Tank Davis. I know that Devin Haney wants to fight Loma and Shakur Stevenson. You know, Teofimo Lopez wants to fight Josh Taylor. All the, you know, these kids want to fight each other. Let them do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, networks, promoters, politics, everything stands in the way. And it is absolutely keeping boxing from rising. Boxing could easily rise if it just gets out of its own way. We've been having that conversation for many years now. To put a button on the Bivol topic, Canelo's out there, just had hand surgery. Eddie Hearn says he'll be back training in full by end of December, early January, theoretically healthy enough to fight in May. Should Canelo pursue the rematch with Dimitri Bivol? He was beaten pretty soundly in that last fight. He's a dominant 168, but at 175, he can beat someone like Sergey Kovalev. Can he compete with Bivol? Can he compete with Beterbiev? That might be just a weight too big at this point for Canelo? Should he pursue the Bivol fight, or should he look in the direction of, say, the winner of David Benavidez versus Caleb Plant, which, cross our fingers, we think is going to happen in the first quarter of 2023?
You know, here's the problem. I picked Canelo to beat Bivol, and I said it was a 50-50 fight, but I thought if it's a close fight in Las Vegas that Canelo's going to win the decision.
I thought so too.
You know, right? So
he almost did get like the Vegas push, because I had it like 17-11, I think, and I don't it wasn't 15-13.
But you know, when you look at that, when you see them in the ring fighting, Bivol's considerably bigger, and the reach, you know, Canelo didn't have a way to really touch him the way he touches a lot of these guys that are his size, because Canelo's an accurate puncher, he's quick, he's got good footwork to put himself in position. He did those things against Bivol, but then Bivol had that little reach advantage on him, pow, with a jab, and that jab would slow Canelo down for a second, and Bivol would throw a combination. So just, are you bringing Bivol down to 68? Is that going to stop that? If Bivol can make 68 healthy, I don't know how Canelo turns that around. Mm. Now, for Canelo, you know, Canelo's like a guy, he likes to say, bleep you, I can do it, and he's going to prove himself to you. And so that's what we love about Canelo, that he has that brash attitude, and that's what we want in a guy. And so from that standpoint, you say, hey, you know, God bless you, you've done so much, go ahead and try. But I like your line of thinking, because I think, you know what, you've proven that size is too big of an issue against you. And if you beat him a second time, there's always going to be that lingering doubt. Well, Bivol came down in weight, and that's not good for him. And Roy Jones proved that, right? When Roy Jones went down after he won the heavyweight title and he went back down to 175, you know, that was a massive mistake. You drop all that muscle off and you're not the same type of fighter that you were before. And who did he fight? Glenn Johnson. I think he got knocked out twice. And that, you know, that became a big issue. So to my way of thinking, Chris, I think Canelo might be better to look at somebody and, you know, hey, he's fought Plant, although Plant has a little bit of heat after that knockout of Durrell. But if Benavidez beats him, and I think, you know, that's the hope that PBC has, because Benavidez is the fresh face, that they can now set Benavidez up to fight him. And to me, that's a great fight for Canelo, because Benavidez is a big kid, right? Yeah. Bigger than Canelo. And I think that's the fight. And then you can have Bivol go fight
Look, Canelo has not been ducking Benavidez. We need to be clear of that.
No.
Like, the idea, like, these trolls out there.
You are a moron if you think that Canelo is ducking Benavidez.
If David Benavidez had not screwed up the WBC title situation, he would have fought Canelo already. Canelo was chasing those belts. He went after the guys with the belts. Then he fought a legacy fight against Gennady Golovkin. He's not ducking Benavidez. And Benavidez, to his credit, has said, I need to earn that fight with Canelo. He's been chasing it. And this Plant fight, after Plant had just stopped Anthony Durrell, is that kind of stepping stone type of fight if he gets there.
It's not a stepping stone fight. It's a good fight.
Yeah, but it would springboard him. I guess stepping stone is the wrong word. Springboard him into a Canelo fight. I don't hate the idea of Canelo waiting until September, fighting David Benavidez, and if he wins and if he comes out clean, there's nothing stopping Canelo from doing one of those Eddie Hearn specialties and fighting overseas somewhere against like a John Ryder type, which has been in the water supply.
He tried that. His first is on.
Yeah, like you can do that. He can get his two fights a year in, make his money, and stay as active as he'd like to stay. I don't hate that idea, but Canelo, as you alluded to, like, he's a little bit crazy. Like, he's, you know, I'm sure it gnaws at him that he lost to Dmitry Bivol. I'm sure it really, really bothers him. I just don't know, to your earlier point, I don't know that he's going to be able to turn the tide on a situation like that. All right, last thing I want to hit you with. You wrote a great piece over at Yahoo Sports about the 13 fights that you want to see in 2023. Some of them are realistic. You've got Fury against Usyk, maybe Fury against Joshua. We could see that. Others, especially in the lower weight classes, not so much. You've got Spence Crawford still doing their thing back and forth. I really love the idea of Inoue versus Stephen Fulton.
Oh, like, that'd be unbelievable.
That's a tremendous fight. If you're Stephen Fulton, what are you doing out there right now? I mean, you're just kind of, I mean, the Akmedaliyev fight, it was never going to come together anyway. Now Akmedaliyev is hurt. Like, you got to strike while the iron's hot. If Inoue moves up, you got to push hard for that type of fight.
Well, he's got the unification fight in December, and then I think they're ready to go.
Oh, yeah. Inoue, I mean, yeah, he's gone. I'm up. Those belts are fractured, and then we'll see what happens. But that to me, when I looked at your list, you know, I love Ryan versus Tank, and I actually think we're getting closer to making a deal on that fight. But when I saw Inoue versus Fulton, man, give me that. Inoue's style of come forward, big power, Fulton more of a slicker boxer. I love that style matchup.
I tried to put fights that I said, okay, what fights do I want to see? And there was a bunch of other ones I wanted, but like Andy Ruiz and Wilder was in the works, so yep. I didn't put that on there. I called for that fight before. Now, I think it's too late, right, and Andy Ruiz's star continues to drop. You know, if he would have fought Wilder instead of Robert Helenius, and forget about Luis, I mean, PBC kept trying to sell the ghost of Luis Ortiz as some threat. And, you know, who did Luis Ortiz ever beat in his professional career? And, yes, he has power, and, you know, yes, he knocked down, you know, Deontay Wilder. But you know what? He got beaten by him, and he's – what can
– did he knock down Wilder? He hurt Wilder.
He knocked him down, didn't he?
No, I think he hurt him in that first fight.
The Brooklyn fight? Okay. I think he hurt him. Not in the second fight, for sure. But, you know, Wilder dominated the second fight. But either way, you know, he had him in some difficulty and was ahead. But who is Ortiz ever beaten? So, to me, the fight – And if Wilder had decided to take a long, even longer off, I would have understood. But Wilder coming off that Fury fight, to me, Andy Ruiz was the fight to make because, you know, Wilder is, like you said about Canelo, crazy. Wilder wants to be in there, and God bless him for the attitude he has. He's one of the guys that wants to make the big fights, and he's looking to fight, you know, the big guys. If you wanted to get one of those fights again, Andy Ruiz was the fight to make, in my opinion. You know, Helenius just didn't have the name power, but I don't know what, you know, the PBC, I guess, was trying to milk every single last thing they could get out of Ortiz. And what did they do? They did a dud of a pay-per-view, and it actually, Andy didn't look great in that fight, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if Andy blows him out and puts him down and puts his arms up in the air while Ortiz is rolling around on the canvas, that's one thing.
He was very tentative in that fight. Knocked Ortiz down a few times, but I don't know if the punch resistance is there for Andy Ruiz like it used to be. I mean, he took that shot from Anthony Joshua, got up, came back, knocked him out, but you look at the Areola
Deontay
fight.
Deontay Wilder is a totally different story.
But Areola knocked him down. I think he was a little bit nervous about Ortiz in that fight and his power. Wilder, I mean, Ruiz could catch Wilder. I mean, like, he's got good hand speed.
That's what makes the fight interesting.
That's what makes, like.
But I tried to look at other fights, Chris, and say, so I brought Joe Joyce up.
Yeah.
Because think about Joe Joyce. To me, he reminds me of a poor man's George Foreman.
Yeah.
Big, strong.
Relentless.
Kind of slow, but he moves forward and he can take a shot. And you would see George come out of those fights, you know, 93, 94, 95. He's wearing the sunglasses. His face got beat up, but somebody's, you know, babbling incoherently in the corner because he knocked the hell out of him. And I think that, you know, that sort of Joe in a lower level reminds me of that. So you're going to tell me Deontay Wilder versus Joe Joyce would not be an unbelievable fight to watch? You know, just from a fan's perspective, it wouldn't be a fun fight. You know somebody's going to get knocked out. You know it's going to be rock'em sock'em robots. And so that's kind of what I tried to do as I went down that list. And, you know, I had to hit some of the obvious ones like Spence and Crawford that were there. But, you know, and I do want to see that fight because I think, you know, you're talking two welterweights in their prime who are, you know, among the five best fighters in the world, would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
And when you have that uplifts boxing when those kind of guys fight. And you can also showcase other elite talent on those undercards, right? I remember many years ago, and I've said this on many interviews, Chris, but when De La Hoya Mayweather got made, I called Richard Schaefer. He was at Golden Boy at the time. And I said, Richard, you should put Rafael Marquez and Israel Vasquez on that undercard. And he said, oh, it's going to cost $1 million to make that fight. What did that fight make? I think it made $280 million that night. Mm-hmm. That $1 million investment would have not helped them that night, but it would help boxing's future. Mm-hmm. People who went away from boxing would have said, holy shit, are these guys, is this what boxing is now? And I think that's what they miss on when they don't put those kind of fights on pay-per-view.
I agree. And if you're going to do pay-per-views, stack them as best you can. I know the money isn't there like it used to be, but you've got to do better than what most of these pay-per-views are, which is a pretty decent headlining fight and then a lot of one-sided fights right on the undercard. It's problematic. Kevin Ioli, you are off to New York to cover UFC this weekend, so we'll be on separate coasts. Even though I live on the East Coast, I'm on the West Coast. You'll be in my backyard.
And it's going to switch back, right?
Yeah. Appreciate your time, Kevin.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
And when we come back, my conversation with Sunisa Estrada.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Now, I'm supposed to talk here about what I remember and what I loved about my first car. And that's easy for me to do because I still have my first car. And as long as it keeps running, and so far so good, I intend to have that car probably until the day I die. That's how much I love that car. It is like a child to me. Now, it does require some upkeep, and that's why I'm grateful for a place like eBay Motors. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED lights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. We're now joined by three-time NBA Sixth Man of the Year, elite bucket getter. Let's please welcome Jamal Crawford to Point Game. King of the Court one-on-one tournament. If they had it back in your prime, do you think he could have took it all?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I could have took it all, but I think I would have shocked a lot of people. I think Kobe and everybody in their prime, Kobe would win a one-on-one contest.
Yeah, because you got to think, he's going to guard. He don't care about guarding.
He's going to guard.
He's going to guard. Like, you see him in the Olympics, he's going to guard. And then on top of that.
I'm not guarding like that, CJ.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Cassell to Point Game.
I remember you came to my room crying tears. he was in a culture shock. And then he's going to withdraw us about winning.
Remember what I told you? I said, OG, you think I can get paid and go back and play in college because it ain't it?
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Colin Cowherd from The Herd with Colin Cowherd. Angie's List is now Angie, the nation's largest home service marketplace. They're here to help homeowners get all their jobs done well. Angie has helped over 150 million homeowners care for their homes. Whatever your home project, big, small, indoor, outdoor, come to Angie to connect with and hire skilled pros to get the job done well.
Listen, I've got a couple of things in a bathroom in my house. Got to get it fixed. I don't have time, and I'm not good at it. Angie is.
In just a few taps in the Angie app or clicks on the site, you can have Angie tackle your home service projects start to finish. With over 200,000 pros in their network, Angie makes it easy to research, compare, and hire pros to ensure a job done well. With 29 years of experience combined with new digital tools to simplify the process, Angie makes completing home projects really easy. Renters, you can use Angie too for moving, installations, or cleaning. Angie can even help with extremely specific projects. Just tell them what you need, and Angie will find the right solution for you. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com. Or download the app today.
While the NBA season is underway, it's the perfect time to download FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Because right now, new customers get a no-sweat first bet up to $1,000. Plus, FanDuel is the only sportsbook that's giving all customers 3 months of NBA League Pass when they make a $5 bet. You guys know from listening to me, following me, I am an NBA guy, and gambling has become a big part of the NBA landscape. It's competitive out there at the moment. And at the moment, you've got some teams like Utah, Portland, teams that you didn't think were going to be that good, they're good. Teams that you thought were going to be good, Philadelphia, aren't quite as good. So some interesting places to make bets right now. FanDuel has all your favorite bets from the money line to point spreads to player props. You can even combine your bets for a chance at a bigger payout with a same game parlay. Plus, with live betting, you'll get updated odds on games that have already started. The FanDuel Sportsbook app is safe, secure, and super easy to use. So download FanDuel today and use promo code BOXING to get your no-sweat first bet up to $1,000. Make every moment more this season with FanDuel, official sportsbook partner of the NBA. All right, Sanisa Estrada is a two-division world champion. On Saturday, she will end an 11-month layoff when she returns to defend her 105-pound title. That's a fight you can watch over on ESPN Plus on Saturday. It is live out here in Las Vegas. She is also the proud protege of a friend of the podcast, Sergio Mora, from the Sergio Mora fighting tree. Is that accurate to say?
That is accurate, unfortunately. It is accurate. He co-hosts with you, right?
He likes to think so.
Oh, so he's not officially a co-host.
No. I just saw, before we sat down to record this, just tweeted out that he's not appearing again on this podcast until I admit that he's my highest rated guest. I will not be admitting that today, since that is inaccurate, and I like to be accurate here on the show, but Sergio is a frequent. We joke, though, but you know, you were an avid
follower of Sergio? You effectively are a stablemate of Sergio since you are trained by Dean Campos, who, of course, was in Sergio's corner for many years during his career. So you are, in a way, a disciple of Sergio.
Yes. I believe it or not, I was a fan of Sergio growing up. I was probably one of his 10 fans growing up. I'm just kidding. No, Sergio had a great style, great footwork and defense. And I grew up training in the same gym as him. I was just training. My dad was training me at the time. And Dean was training Sergio. They were getting ready to go through the Olympic trials. And then after that, he got onto the Contender TV show and went through that, won it, and started training with Dean when I was 16. And it was because I loved Sergio's style. I always thought
What was it about that style that you loved?
Just, it was different. His footwork and defense was great. Of course, Sergio doesn't have power, and that was... Sorry, Sergio. But everybody knows that.
He would admit that.
He wasn't a power puncher. But that's why Dean had to create all these different moves and training methods and techniques for him to be able to win fights against fighters who are a lot stronger or even a lot more experienced than him, so he can get through these fights. And his style worked, our style. I mean, I fight that way too, with my footwork and my defense and my movement, except I have the power, so that makes it even easier for me.
for people that don't understand like what made his footwork special, when you watched his footwork, what did you see and what did you try to kind of emulate?
I mean, foot placement is so important in boxing. That makes a huge difference as to, I mean, for example, we saw that last weekend with the Bivol and Zurdo fight. His foot placement was just perfect, and that's what made his punches be so precise and accurate and made it easier for him to land all the punches that he wanted to. So when watching Sergio, I just recognized and noticed how his foot placement was always just so good. It put him in positions to where he was able to land punches from the side of opponents and land punches from all different angles. Like, you didn't know where Sergio was going next. And that's the same thing with me and my style. Like, my opponents don't know what I'm going to do next, because I'm always keeping them guessing, but I always know what I'm going to do next.
You switch a lot in the ring too. Sergio didn't switch that much, did he?
He didn't switch as much, but yes, he was very good at throwing certain punches out of a southpaw stance, because that's what Dean does teach us.
That's tricky, right? I mean, there's only a handful of fighters that really switch in boxing. Terence Crawford does it at a pretty high level. I'm blanking, but I'm sure there's a few others. Like, that's not easy to kind of master, because you've got to be really comfortable in both stances, right?
You do, and I'm actually very comfortable. I'm more comfortable in a southpaw stance than I am in an orthodox stance. Like, even Dean was like, man, like, you can do certain things easier out of a southpaw stance. And when I started boxing, I would always stand left-handed, and my dad would always make me turn back to my orthodox stance. But as time went on, he noticed that I was doing things so much better out of a southpaw stance, and it was kind of just working what I was doing. So he kind of just let me be and let me switch back and forth when I felt it was necessary.
Mm. Everybody knows now women's boxing is experiencing like an unbelievable surge. You've got women making 7-figure paydays. The biggest boxing matches on men's or women's side are being fought by women. You know, you go back to Katie Taylor, Amanda Serrano a couple weekends ago. You had a great card over in the UK where both women's fights were impressive. I want to ask you about that, but when you first started in boxing, back when you were 8-9 years old, what was women's boxing back then? Like, what do you remember women's boxing being when you first picked up those gloves?
Well, I started watching boxing with my dad when I was about 6 years old, and the first question I asked him was, Dad, do girls box? Because we didn't watch any women on TV. It was just men. So I didn't think that women's boxing even existed. So growing up, getting into boxing, I didn't realize how dead women's boxing was. In LA, I was one of maybe 3 girls who were going into every gym in East LA for sparring, and in LA,
because it was still Christy Martin, Leila Ali.
Yeah,
at the end, like the end of that, like Lucia Riker, kind of. There wasn't in professional level. It was more
right.
I don't want to say gimmicky, but it was few and far between we saw women's fights.
Yeah, it wasn't enough to like keep
no depth whatsoever.
No depth. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So, it was pretty difficult coming growing up in LA, being one of the very few girls walking into a boxing gym, and all my sparring partners were boys. It was hard to even find another girl to spar with. So to see how far it's come now is just incredible. Like, I've always known it would get to the point where it is now. I just didn't know when. That's the one thing about women's boxing. Getting into women's boxing that early was just so unpredictable. And wanting to turn pro, I had no idea how dead women's boxing still was at the time. And my professional career was a very slow start because I was so inactive. Big promoters weren't signing women. Women weren't fighting on TV. But now the breakthrough has been incredible. And it's just been in the past couple of years. This year actually is like you said, the best year that women's boxing has had ever.
Well, when did you decide that this would be a career path? Like, when does it go from being something you want to do because you sit in front of a TV and watch and ask your dad, or do women box, to this is something I want to do for most of my life?
I knew that when I was 7, before I started boxing. I started boxing at 8 years old. But when I was 7, I was sitting in front of the TV watching a boxing fight. I don't even remember which fight specifically. But I thought to myself, this is what I want to do. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. Well, not the rest of my life, but, you know.
As a
professional, this is going to be my career. I'm going to be a world champion one day. I'm going to fight on TV one day, and I'm going to be signed by one of the biggest promoters in boxing one day. I said that at 7 years old when, like my dad thought I was fucking crazy. he thought I was insane. Of course, my mom did too for a very long time. But I just knew it. I knew it. And I knew women's boxing would be where it is right now.
And your dad, as he's been around, he's around every one of your fights, works your corner along with Dean. You've told the story before, but he was initially skeptical of it, right? Like, he threw you in with a boy your first time out.
Yeah. When I first asked him if I can box, he avoided taking me to a gym for about 6 months. I was constantly just bugging him. And I think it got to the point where he was just annoyed. So he was like, all right, fine. Like, I'll take her to a gym. And I was training for about 2 weeks, and he still didn't want me boxing. So he asked my trainer at the time to put me in the ring to spar with a boy so he can beat me up, make me cry. That way I would not want to go back to the gym ever
again. As every good father wants to do. Right. Make his 8-year-old daughter cry.
So I get in there with the boy, and the boy had been sparring, had been boxing for a few months. Get in there. My technique was awful. I didn't know what I was doing. All I knew was, I just wanted to go in there and just fight. And that's what I did. So I ended up making the boy cry, making him quit. And he never came back to the gym again. So the plan kind of backfired on my dad. But I think even though he didn't show it in his facial expressions, in his mind, he was thinking, holy shit, like she has potential, and there's something there. Like, I gotta give her a chance to at least see what she can do in this sport.
How does Dean get involved in your life? I mean, he became well known as the trainer for Sergio Mora. When Sergio wins the contender, goes on to world championship level fights for Ernest Forrest twice. Obviously, Dean intimately involved in that. When does he get involved in your career?
So around the time where I knew that I wanted to turn pro, me and my dad had a talk, and I was like, I want Dean to train me, because I knew, like, I had a great amateur career. I had over 100 amateur fights, and my style's never been very amateurish. So I knew I would have an easy transition into the pros, but I knew that I had to be better. I wanted to get better. Like, I still want to get better every single fight. I want to be better. So I told my dad, I think Dean would be the perfect person to just teach me new things and take me to another level. And my dad, like, what's so great about him is he's not one of those boxing fathers who just want full control of their kid's career. And that was the great thing. I think that was the best decision he could have ever made, was letting Dean take full control over my style and everything that Dean wants to teach me. So we were still training at the same gym as Dean, as we've always had. And my dad goes into the gym one day and says, Dean, can you help me out with Sunisa? It was, you know, we just wanted to, we kind of wanted to like break them in easily and say, you know, just help her out and show her some new things. So Dean hates women's boxing. Hated women's boxing.
Past tense.
Should I say, yeah. Past tense. And he was not up for training me. My dad gave him some old tapes and he left them there and he said, here's some tapes if you want to check them out. And Dean would see me sparring in the gym here and there, but you know, that was pretty much it. So Dean said he was bored one night. He throws on my old tapes and he starts watching me and he's like, he thinks to himself, wow, like she's doing stuff that Sergio doesn't even do, or doing stuff as a kid that took Sergio years to even perfect or learn. And I was just fighting off of instinct. Mm. And so he gave me, we came to the gym the next day and he's like, all right, I'll help her out. I'll show her some things. So Dean still didn't want to train me 100%. So he thought, okay, well, let me show her some things. It's going to just blow her mind and she's not going to understand it. And she's going to say, I don't want to train with Dean anymore. So he taught me this move. I mean, I can't explain it. I would have to get up and show you. So he taught me this move and I had sparring set up already the next day. So he's like, well, try it in sparring if you can, you know, no big deal if you can't do it. And I thought to myself, this is easy. I'm going to do this in sparring. Like I already knew in my mind that I was going to do it multiple times, not just one time. Get in the ring. I do the move that he showed me the day before. And we still have the footage of that. You could hear Dean say, tell my dad, Joe, she fucking did it. She did the move. Oh my God. And he's like, it took Sergio fucking 2 years to perfect this move. And she just did it the next day after I showed it to her. So after that, I think kind of the same thing with my dad. When my dad first put me in the ring and didn't think I was capable of doing anything, Dean kind of thought the same thing. And after that, it just made it so easy for him to just train me and teach me things, because I just picked up on everything so quickly and easily.
You hear that a lot, or I hear that a lot from women's boxing trainers, the skepticism they have coming into it, and then how happy they are that they did, whether it's Al Mitchell and Michaela Mayer, Ross Enemé and Katie Taylor, mm-hmm. and now Dean, who you're basically his stable at this point,
right, yeah.
as far as professionals go, and he's totally committed to working with you.
Yeah, and that's crazy, because I remember when I first turned pro, he didn't tell me this because he didn't want to discourage me and make me feel bad. So, but now he told me years later that he thought to himself, man, if this girl makes $50,000 in her entire professional career, like, I'll be happy with that. And then when I made my first $100,000 for one fight, he was like, oh, fuck. Like, this is okay. Like, this is different. Like, things are changing. And I don't blame him for not wanting to train me, or blame other trainers for not wanting to train women, because I didn't like women's boxing either when I was coming up as a kid. Like, the fights that I would see on TV or would see in the pros, the skill level was just terrible. Mm-hmm. Like, why would you want to see that? You know, it just wasn't where it's at now. Now women are so skilled. If you don't like women's boxing and you watch the top women like Katie, Amanda, Clarissa, me, Michaela, all the top women, our skill level is so good that whether or not you're a women's boxing fan, you're going to become one watching us, because you just can't deny the talent level.
You didn't have the traditional amateur pop that some of these other women had, with Katie winning a gold medal and competing in two Olympics, Clarissa winning two gold medals, Michaela Mayer coming out of the 2016 Olympics. What was your first breakthrough? Like, what do you feel like was your Olympic moment where you kind of got that bounce that put you on another level?
In the amateurs?
Well, not the amateurs, because you were in the pros.
Oh, okay.
You know, first, but like, what was your breakthrough moment, like in the pro ranks?
I would say it all started with Tom Loeffler giving me the opportunity to fight on multiple Triple G undercards and then Chocolatito cards, because obviously those brought in so many people. Those were big cards, and
Tom did a lot of stuff behind the scenes that doesn't get a lot of credit
for.
Whether it's the flyweights and mainstreaming them, and as you said, you know, women's boxing, putting you on those cards.
Yeah, and he put me on those cards, of course, because I was able to sell a lot of tickets in LA, which is great. You know, of course, it was great for me.
Tom does love when you sell tickets. That's another thing.
Yeah, Tom loves. I mean, it's business. He wouldn't have put me on those cards if I couldn't sell tickets. So, but yeah, I love Tom. We still have a great relationship, and man, it's been almost 10 years since I've known him, and I'm thankful that he gave me that opportunity to be on all those cards, and that's what gave me that breakthrough. I remember when I was on my first Triple G undercard, Roy Jones was ringside with Max and they were rehearsing. And Roy kept looking back and watching my fight while they were trying to rehearse. And I can hear someone say, "Roy, like, we're rehearsing." And Roy's like, no, stop, wait a minute. And Roy stopped the rehearsal, kept watching my fight until it was over. And then the next day at, I believe it was, who was he training at the time? Jesse Vargas, I believe. He helped him for a fight. At the press conference, I went to do some media interviews, and I was sitting in the crowd, and he completely stopped the press conference. He was like, "I know this is completely off the record right now, but you see that girl right there?" And he pointed at me, and I even looked behind me. I was like, "Girl, who is he talking about?" And he's like, "Stand up, tell everybody your name." And I was like, "Sunisa." And I was so nervous, and I was like, "Oh my God, like, that's Roy Jones, my hero. One of my favorite fighters of all time, besides Sugar Ray Leonard." So to hear him talk about me and just give me all those compliments was just incredible. Like, I cried. I was like, "Oh my God, like, I can't believe this." And him saying that to all of the media that was there after that, it made all of the local LA media just so, a lot of them already knew me, but the ones who didn't, it just created this huge buzz around me. And that's when everybody was like interested and like, man, women's boxing can make some progression. I think that's when people started to see that. And then after that, Tom was like, "Okay, you're on this card, you're on that card, you're on the next card." He had me booked for Triple G undercards and Chocolatito undercards months before they were happening. He's like, "You're on, that's your spot, like, get ready," you know. So that was great, because before that I was very inactive. My professional career started so slow. And then from those cards, that led to Golden Boy wanting to sign me. And that was right
after. How big a moment was that for you? Because you grew up in East LA, same as Oscar De La Hoya. You were obviously well aware of his accomplishments.
Right.
Was that something that you were hoping to do at that stage of your career, to be part of whatever Oscar was doing at that time?
Definitely. I you know, being from East LA, Oscar was just somebody who inspired so many people. And them signing Esparza first out of the Olympics, I think the Olympic thing kind of definitely helped in so many ways. Katie came out of there, and then Clarissa after that. So signing with Golden Boy was huge. It was great.
And they, I mean, and you fought for two world titles with them. I mean, how big, I mean, people talk, nowadays everybody kind of looks at titles sort of in a negative light at some point. Oh, it's secondary title, this. People criticize titles. But for you winning that first world title, what did that mean to you as part of your journey?
It was great. I mean,
well, okay, good quote. Well,
that's when people ask me that, I don't know. I think they expect me to say a whole speech of how I felt and how great it was.
I don't know. I put my covers of Sports Illustrated on the wall. Like, that's my world title. Like, that's,
I mean, my world titles and the two other intern belts that I've won, all four of those belts are sitting on the floor in my bedroom. Not that I don't care about them, but it's just that first world title, it was satisfying. That's all I can say. It was satisfying, but it's because I'm so competitive and there's so much more that I want. One bout is nothing to me. I want to be undisputed at 105, 108, and 112. So I give myself no credit yet. I think once I accomplish that, then I'll be happy with myself.
And you had to, I mean, when you were younger, just trying to get fights, you must have had to jump up and down and weight outside of your weight class a lot just to get some of these fights.
In the pros?
Yeah.
Yes. But I had been doing that since I was an amateur. I would weigh in with my dad's keys and cell phones in my pocket so I can get a fight, because there wasn't many young girls at the time or women fighting. So I would have to weigh in with all of that stuff in my pocket, all my clothes on, just so I can jump three weight classes and fight someone. And that also transitioned into the professionals. I was fighting out of my weight class just all through the beginning of my career until I signed with Golden Boy. I was fighting girls who were naturally bantamweights. I was eating and stuffing my face with food just so I can try to get close to the weight so we can make the fight happen. And once I signed with Golden Boy, I was able to finally fight girls who were naturally at my weight class, which is when all the knockouts started coming. So I always knew I had the natural power. I just wasn't able to show it. So if I would have started my career with Golden Boy, I would be 22-0 with at least 18 knockouts.
One of my favorite, no, it's not favorite, but I like, one of the movies I like is there's this movie that James Franco is, he's in the military and he's a boxer and he's on the scale and he's eating a Snickers bar while he's on the scale to get to a weight to fight the guy he's wanted to fight. Have you ever had to just pig out to get to within a certain weight range to take a fight?
Oh yeah. I did that at least, I mean, every single fight I had before signing with Golden Boy. I signed with them when I was, what, 12-0, I believe? And every single fight before
because, so
that,
just so people know, you have to, if you're going to fight at, say, 115, you've got to be at 112, right? You've got to
at least
be
three
within
pounds.
3 pounds of that weight, or else you're in a different weight class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would eat, I remember one time when I fought on, I think it was a Chocolatito undercard, and I had to gain about another 3 pounds just to make that weight limit so the fight can happen. And I had, my dad ran to McDonald's. I ate a whole meal, double cheeseburger, fries, downed a whole Gatorade. Still wasn't enough. So he went to Randy's Donuts and got me this giant bear claw and a huge milk.
So gross.
It was disgusting. I wanted to throw up, but I had to do it. And ended up barely making the weight. So, I mean, things like that are just, it's funny to now when I look back and I think, like, what was I thinking fighting these girls who were so freaking huge? I'm like, I'm insane for doing that. But at the same time, it's what I wanted to do. It's what I had to do in order to build my record and to stay active. And
Bear Claw and McDonald's, it would take me 3 days to get that out of my system.
It would
just
disgusting.
Be sitting in my stomach.
I was disgusted with myself.
Just so you want to hear from a fighter.
And then, oh, and then when I fought Esparza, even though that was 112 pounds, I was still walking around at, I don't know, maybe 110. So when I fought Esparza fight week, I was at the buffet at the MGM eating pizza every day. And I still weighed in at, what was it, maybe 110 point something. On fight night, I was 109. I went back down. So, I mean, those are just things that I had to go through that now just make they make all the success now just feel even sweeter, knowing that I went through all that crap.
You've spent the last few years with Golden Boy. You've been off for 11 months in part because you decided to separate from Golden Boy and have signed with Top Rank. I know there's a lot you can't say about what happened there, but was it disappointing to, you know, growing up a fan of Oscar to not have it work out with Golden Boy?
Yes, it was very disappointing. I mean, I don't know what else to say other than we just couldn't come to an agreement as far as how much money I wanted. And I mean, I wasn't asking for $1 million a fight. I was not even asking anything close to that. But hey, I'm back and I'm with Top Rank, and I got a great deal with Top Rank. It's what I wanted, and it's what I with what I feel I deserve. And these past 11 months, I felt like I was missing out on so much because I'm just so competitive. Like, I want to fight all the champions. I want to have unification fights. I want to be undisputed. And this year, I wasn't able to do that. So I felt like I just wasted a whole year. And then now that I'm back, I think totally differently because I see how great of a year women's boxing had, starting off with Katie and Serrano and just continuing on with all these other big, great matchups. And now I think to myself, you know what? Those 11 months were not wasted at all because I'm back ending the year that was already an incredible year for women's boxing. There's no better time to come back in women's boxing than right now. And all that time that I was off, I was still in the gym, sparring to stay sharp, working on things that I wanted to improve on. So nothing, no, there was no time wasted at all.
I think a lot of people, when they saw you were going to be a free agent, assumed you would sign with Matchroom. Matchroom has largely cornered the market on women's boxing. They probably control 90% of the top women's boxers that are out there across continents, whether mm-hmm. it's Alicia Baumgartner here in the U.S., Katie Taylor in the U.K., Ebony Bridges fights from Australia. What was the process like in deciding who to sign with next?
I love Eddie, and I think he does an incredible job with women's boxing, and I even told him that. And when I met with Eddie, the one thing like I'll always love and respect about Eddie is that he not only did he say, like, I mean, he told me, he's like, of course I want to sign you, would love to sign you, and I will if you know it comes to that. But he also gave me advice, which is what I appreciated so much, is that he gave me advice as to what I should do as far as making the right decision with a promoter. And when I found out that Top Rank wanted to sign me, not only was the deal great, but it just made so much more sense. Eddie doesn't have any minimum weights, light flyweights, or flyweights. If he would have signed me, I know for a fact he would have signed more women at my weight class, of course, for me. But the whole, everything about the deal with Top Rank just all came together. And then the ESPN platform, I feel like it's being from LA and Mexican American, I just feel it's a perfect platform and it's where I belong.
Did it surprise you that Top Rank was interested at first? They have done a great job with Michaela, promoted her the entirety of her pro career. But at the time, she was the only women's boxer as part of their company. And we were just months removed from Bob Arum having some critical comments about women's boxing. When you first got the call from someone at Top Rank, what was your reaction?
I was pretty surprised. I mean, I know that I'm a perfect fighter to sign as far as to represent women's boxing and with Top Rank. Like, I know that. But like you said, they have not signed any other females besides Michaela. So I was a little surprised that they were really interested in signing me. And they Bob's comments didn't bother me at all about women's boxing. I mean, what promoter hasn't said anything negative about women's boxing? Mm. But it all came together, and I'm just so grateful to be back with Top Rank. And I've always been a fan of Michaela's, not just in her professional career, but in the amateurs as well. So I've always watched every Michaela fight, and I've always recognized how well they've moved her career in the pros. I thought they've done such a great job with her as far as promotion, marketing, and putting the money into her and taking all the risks that they needed to take in order to make sure that people know who she is. Mm. And I thought that was always amazing of everything that they put into her. I always noticed that. So I always thought to myself, if I was a Top Rank, like, I know they would back me up in that way and put all that they possibly could into me.
What has your Bob Arum experience been like?
Bob is great. He's a funny guy. He's a funny, sweet guy. I can't wait to spend more time with him.
And he'll whatever he said about women's boxing before, he'll go out there and promote you.
Like, exactly.
He'll be ringside at your fight. He'll be at your press conferences. He'll promote. He's old school. You know, if you're part of his stable, he's going to go out there and promote you, even at almost 91 years old.
Yes,
as best as he can.
He's at every single fight, and he's sitting there even during the undercard fights that aren't even televised. Like, that just shows how much he puts into his promotional company.
So you return to the ring on Saturday, and this is a comeback fight. It's a defense of your 105-pound title. In your mind, what does 2023 look like for you?
2023 is going to be a huge year for me. Get past this fight. Argentinian fighters are tough. My opponent, I already know, is going to come to win for sure. Everyone who faces me has their biggest opportunity to defeat the underdog and take the spotlight. And who wouldn't want to come in to defeat me? So I know she's coming to win, which I don't take any of my opponents lightly because of that. So get through this fight and have my first unification fight in early 2023 is our plan with the WBC world champion from Germany. After that, hopefully have another unification fight at 105, and then I'll have all the bouts at 105. So my plan at the end of the year is to have my first fight at 108 and start unifying there. And Top Rank is right behind me with all that, willing to make it happen. So,
And with all the big fights happening in women's boxing, a rematch with you and Marlon Esparza is still massive. You guys obviously have some spiciness to the rivalry there still, which is quite frankly great. I mean, we saw what the nastiness between Alicia Baumgartner and Michaela Mayer did for that fight. Everybody was eager to see those two get in the ring. I assume that's still very much on your radar to do a rematch with Marlon at 112.
Definitely. I still want to rematch with Esparza. I want to just shut her up once and for all. I want that to happen, and that's definitely still on my radar for sure. Hopefully she keeps winning and keeps getting all the bouts. So
it's a big money fight for both of you. Like, that's a huge, huge event if that can happen sometime in the next year, year and a half. Last thing for you. What's, like, people talk all the time. I heard Clarissa Shields talking this week about it. Maybe she'll fight Katie Taylor. Like the dream hypothetical fight. We used to see it in men's boxing with Manny Pacquiao and Oscar De La Hoya. Nobody thought they would ever fight. They did, and it turned out to be a huge moment. I doubt Clarissa and Katie fight, but, you know, we can dream about that. Is there, like, a way up in weight, way above your weight class, like, end of your career, like, a dream fight for you that, like, let's roll the dice and see what happens at a different weight?
Yeah, if I were to just take a huge risk and just face an opponent way out of my, well, I would do it out of my weight class, so I would say a bantamweight. I would want to fight Ebony Bridges. I love Ebony. I think she does a great Ebony, you do an amazing job at just promoting yourself and not giving a shit what anybody thinks. I think it would be a fight that the fans would love. I feel like the promotion for the fight would be great. So, and then of course it's a huge risk for me because I'm so much smaller. So it would be an exciting fight.
118, you'd have to.
I would eat my way up. I would. I mean, I'll have a very happy training camp. I'll be at McDonald's every day.
Now that sounds like something Sergio would say. That sounds like something that I'll be at McDonald's every day. You must remember some of his weight cuts. Like he's told me many stories about the cut for Forrest 2 when he had to take the rematch.
He
like
almost
six.
Died. Yeah.
What,
he almost
what
died.
Do you remember about that?
Well, I remember Sergio just not. I couldn't believe how the fight was just so so soon. I mean, as far as how much time he had to prepare. And Sergio, he loses weight in not a very healthy way. Let's just say.
You don't say.
Yeah.
you don't say.
But I don't take any weight loss advice from Sergio, that's for sure.
He always says he lost that fight on the scale, even though he didn't lose it on the scale. He actually made 154, but he always said I was a zombie after that weigh-in.
He was, yeah. he almost died. Dean found him underneath. He was trying to lose weight, and Dean found him passed out, just arms just spread wide open, laying on the floor. Dean walked up to him and thought he was dead, and like he was like, there's no way you're – like we have to – Dean was like, I have to get him through this fight without him getting hurt or knocked out. So good thing Sergio's footwork and defense came through because that kept him from, you know, getting knocked out and possibly dying.
As a friend of Sergio's, do you support or are you against his passionate desire to fight Jake Paul in a fight?
Oh, my gosh. I would love to see that. Yeah. I would love to see Jake Paul just hit Sergio with his right hand and just put him down.
I've told it's too big a risk for him. Like, if he gets caught with, like, I mean, Sergio's even at 42.
Sergio has kinesio tape all over his body. He's like a mummy.
But even at 42, he's probably a better boxer than Jake. But if your feet aren't there and he hits you with something.
Exactly.
Like, that's your career. Like, that's how you're not the contender winner anymore. You're not a world champion. You're the ex-champion that got knocked out by Jake Paul.
Yes.
Just stay retired. Keep commentating.
I would love to see I would love to see the shit talk that Jake would go after Sergio with. It would be amazing.
I think they both would.
They
like
both
the,
would,
the
yes.
Build-up would be, like, there's, like, maybe Tommy Fury, but there's very few boxers that would talk the way Sergio could talk in a build up for a fight like that. He would run his mouth daily on every social media.
And Sergio's training camp would be incredible. He'd smoke cigars before and after training sessions. He would, just be the typical Sergio, gambling and smoking cigars, drinking beer.
Would Dean Campos take him back?
I don't know about that. No, Dean would always
be a check in it. Yeah,
Dean would definitely be in the corner only because he's concerned that Sergio would be taken out of the ring in a freaking stretcher if he wasn't there in Sergio's corner. So yes, Dean would definitely be there.
Well, hopefully we're not going to that fight anytime soon. Sunisa Estrada back this Saturday defending her 105-pound titles. Welcome back and thanks for joining me.
Thank you. I am now your highest rated Mexican guest over Sergio.
Sorry, Sergio. That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Kevin Ioli and Sunisa Estrada for joining the show. As always, subscribe, rate, review this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you download podcasts. And we'll see you next week.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Tired of restless nights? At Leesa, we know good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. From memory foam mattresses to hybrids that keep you cool all night long, Leesa's mattresses offer exceptional comfort and support with free delivery and 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to leesa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. Exclusions apply. See leesa.com for more details.
I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man and being a country megastar while also having 7 kids. You know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.